Hey guys.
Hello.
Hey guys.
How are you?
We are great.
We are good.
We are great.
Hold on, just making sure we are fitting properly.
Yeah, we're kind of far apart.
Yeah, see, it's funny, I was watching a documentary about Atlantis. There's a thing called...
Oh God, don't say Freaknik.
That's it, Freaknik.
Oh man, what did
I was
you
like, I need to talk to you guys about Freaknik. Did you guys go to Freaknik when you were...
I do remember riding through it, but I was never, you know, I wasn't twerking on top of cars or nothing. I was still a child.
Yeah, and I'm older than she is, so my memories of Freaknik was more so on trying to go. Pretty much, you didn't even have to go anywhere because the party was on the highway. And it wasn't all debauchery, but yeah, I mean, that was a pretty accurate description of kind of how it all played out.
Okay.
I can't imagine that happening in the UK.
I was thinking, wow, these Americans are wild.
Yeah, some of us are. Welcome to the Rich and Regular podcast, where we explore life at the intersection of money. I'm Kirsten.
And I'm Julian. And if you've ever wondered what we would sound like if we had a British accent, then you're in luck. Today, we are so happy to be speaking with Ken and Mary Okorafor. They are old friends of ours, though we've actually never met. They were one of the first people that reached out to us when we launched our blog back in 2017. They are the couple behind thehumblepenny.com. They are the authors of the new book, Financial Joy. They are the financial educators behind the Financial Joy Academy, and so much more. And so this conversation, I would have to say, is one of my favorites that we've had in a really, really long time. And so we're really glad to be sharing with you.
Yes, enjoy and buy their book.
I want to go back in time. We launched our blog September 2017. It was a little bit after Kirsten's birthday and our anniversary. This is just basically what September means. Like, at this point, we know that September is just a very busy month. But we launched our blog in September 2017. And I would say a little bit, it was maybe just shy of a year. I get this email from a guy named Ken. Let me read this email.
Oh, wow. He's got it.
It says, I was super excited to come across your site today. We found you through Playing with Fire and immediately thought to ourselves, they too are the fearless generation. The fire is spreading and we are making it happen here in the UK. We hope to get to know you guys and possibly even work together, guest posts, etc., if you're keen. I never use the word keen before. This is when I said, this isn't spam. I said, this isn't spam. I think he actually is in the UK. My question is, what made you so passionate about spreading the message about FIRE then?
Yes.
And would you say you are more or less passionate now?
Wow. I'm so honored that you still got the email. That's just like, that's incredible. What made me so passionate? So there are a number of things. So going back to, so you guys started in 2017 September. We began in December 2017, right?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's when we started the Humble Penny. So it was, we felt around that time of our lives, we felt there was a massive lack of awareness of the possibility of financial independence in the UK.
In the UK.
It was just like lacking. Mm-hmm. Now, we'd read a lot of the American blogs, and a lot of those American blogs were by people who we identified with what they were trying to do and we aspired towards them, we couldn't really relate to them very much.
Yeah.
So we were like, do you know what? Like, why is it all these guys are talking about this stuff? Like, where are our people? Like, where are people who we can connect with talking about this stuff? And there were not that very many. Mm-hmm. And so I was working as a chief financial officer in my day job, my corporate job, and Mary was working, running a nursery business in her day job. Actually, you had started running. 2017. Yeah, 2017. Yeah, you had. So But we felt, I just felt this sense of desire to start to talk about this stuff, because part of my job back then was I was the UK finance director for an American business that had a European headquarters in the UK. So I would fly over to a place called Oaks, Pennsylvania in America for work once every like 4 months. And every time I'd be on that flight, I just felt like, wow, like my life, I felt like there was a big gaping hole. Like I just felt like I was missing something in my life. And I wanted to do something more creative, something more fulfilling. And because I've been reading all those American blogs, I said to Mary, do you know what? I think this is the thing. Why don't we just like, let's just start talking about it, but talking about it from our lived experiences as a couple who are immigrants to the UK. I'm first generation. I wasn't born in the UK. Mary was born in London, but I emigrated from Lagos in Nigeria. And I kind of come with my own challenges, my own struggles, you know, trying to fight for residency, trying to fight for just my own space, you know, trying to integrate into a new culture. So there's so many things that I felt like that aren't being talked about. And I felt like, wow, like there's no one talking about these core challenges that are affecting so many people. Why not? So we just thought it could be us. But then we had a fear. There's a big fear, because the big fear was, first of all, I'm African. I'm Nigerian. There aren't any Nigerians doing this stuff. Our surname is the longest surname. It's not John Smith. It's not like William. It's not like one of those easy names that people can just like embrace and go, oh, yeah. I feel like I can relate to this. It's like Okorafo. It's like, who will embrace a name like that? So it was that fear of... Yeah. Can a black man or a black couple be trusted to talk about money? There's so many struggles with identity with starting this project. But anyway, we chose to start.
We did.
Now, did you guys have kids back then? Because our son was like 6 months. How old are your kids?
Now they are
11 and 9.
Okay, so you guys are a little bit ahead of us. Yeah. Mary, have you thought about the advantages that you're able to give them, raising them, that maybe you didn't have when you were a kid?
Oh, so many. So my parents migrated over to London in the late 70s, and there wasn't really much of a community for them. And so nobody was talking about money. They were very good with their money in terms of they were very frugal. They lived within their means. But there were just certain things that they didn't do on time, like purchasing a council house, like when so many people around us were purchasing their house for peanuts. And when my parents finally did get around to purchasing it, it quadrupled in value. And so they're actually still paying it off till now, and they retired a long time ago. So, yeah, it's just having that advantage of knowing how to invest. All I knew how to do was to save my money and make my savings grow and then stick in a cash ISA. But now our children, they're co-investing with us, and we're showing them their portfolio, and they're seeing it grow and able to ask us questions, and when we're informed and we're able to answer, you know, so there's that. And then obviously they're able to see their parents being able to create value and then get paid for creating value and solving a problem. So
they're loving seeing us as entrepreneurs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They get to see their parents as entrepreneurs. They get to see the flexibilities that we have and the fact that we're always present. We're able to attend their school events, their sports days, and all their assemblies. So they love that mum and dad can be present, are present. Yeah.
That's amazing. Any advice out there for parents who are listening to this and want to unlock that level of partnership? Maybe they have entrepreneurial ambitions, maybe not, but they're just looking to get in better lockstep with their spouse on how to raise their children to be investors. Do you have any advice or anything that has been helpful for you to remember when times get hard or when you feel like quitting?
Yeah, I've got quite a few things. So I'd say the first thing is, one thing that's helped us a lot is being aligned from a family value, family vision perspective.
Yeah.
So a lot of couples aren't aligned at all. So one person wants to spend, the other person wants to invest, or they just have very different relationships with money. And the way they look at money is very different. So one thing I've found has helped Mary and I a lot, and it's helping the way we raise our children, is just knowing that we are aligned when it comes to what's the overall goal for our family and what we're trying to achieve. And that's just helping to demonstrate, first of all, unity as a value to our children. So children can see that, wow, like mommy and daddy are really like on the same page. Like, yes, they disagree sometimes, but they're actually fundamentally aiming in the same direction. And that's very important for children to see, because then they're like, wow, okay, you know, they can watch mom and dad and they can observe and they can try to soak up certain habits that they see mom and dad exhibiting. And I think that's so fundamentally important, because a lot of couples don't progress as much because they're just not, that foundation isn't built yet. And so that's a really good starting point. Now, the other is we find actually using everyday things as ways of teaching our children things. I'll give you a really random example. Imagine I'm doing a school run and get to drop the kids at school, and we pull up and there's a lot of traffic. And I look to my left-hand side and I see a load of shops to my side. One of the conversations that I love having with our kids is, guys, look at those shops. Which of those shops do you think makes the most money and why? Right? Just using everyday things. And it gets the children thinking a lot. You know, they'll say, oh, okay, that shop has a lot of traffic. And this, the average value of their products might be, say, £5 or $5. If they get this many number of customers, then they might have this much sales in a day. And that sort of stuff. So having conversations where you're looking around and using everyday things not only encourages conversation between parents and their children, which is very lacking these days, because children are glued to their devices, they're on their games a lot, and so there's a lot of isolation, and parents are also glued to their devices and on Instagram and doing their things. So parents and children aren't really, think about it, aren't really conversating a lot of the time. But if you use everyday things around you, it helps to not only create that conversation, but it also creates a teachable moment. So I think parents just need to get on the same page with their partner if they can, and then use every day as opportunities to create dialogue with their children.
Yeah. And just to add to that as well, we love to teach them how to become producers as opposed to consumers. Like, think like a producer. Who are your favorite YouTubers? How do you think they make money? You know, what value are they bringing, or what problem are they solving? But also, we just teach them to have pots from an early age, so they get a lot of pocket money and birthday money from their grandparents for birthdays. And we just teach them that, you know, yes, use some of the money to buy your toys or games or whatever, but give 10% to charity, invest 20% of it, and then you can spend the rest of it. So they know that whenever money comes in, they shouldn't just spend it all on toys. There's like an allocation, a slight allocation for each thing.
I love this so much for so many reasons, because as you guys are talking, I'm obviously envisioning our son, and we do literally the exact same thing. I'm sure Kirsten is thinking the same thing. I've got a long list of stories where I find everyday things, everyday moments. Because we think so much about money, we find these opportunities to use these moments, whether it's him playing baseball or him playing video games or an experience in class, that we can use as a financial lesson that either is introducing something new or reinforcing a core principles. Now, I will say, in his class, they have an incentive program where the better you behave or you ask the right kind of questions or display certain kinds of qualities, you get X amount of points. And as you accrue these points, you can cash these points in for
a treasure box.
Little treasure box. You get to pick something, you know, out of the gift, out of the treasure box.
Yeah.
And our son is, if I'm not mistaken, the only one in the class that has like hundreds of points. Absolutely refuses to spend them. He's misinterpreted the message a little bit. I think he believes he can carry over these points into second grade. So we're actually now encouraging him to use his points before he loses them. But it is interesting to see that we uncovered that. And then we, again, use that as an opportunity to say, well, this isn't like money. This isn't like investing. You actually do want to go ahead and spend your points. I don't know that your next teacher is going to be able to, is going to use this exact same system. But I want to change gears a little bit, because one of the other things in your book that I found really interesting. I tend to enjoy these moments that I just consider to be turning points, like this moment where something bad happens, something challenging happens, and you make a decision to say, this is not something that I want to do. So in our life, I certainly remember when I proposed to Kirsten. She was actually struggling with a neck issue because she was overworking herself. I've had issues and challenges with burnout, and my body started to show signs of that in my 30s, which was really alarming to me because I didn't anticipate that I would have those experiences or feelings until my 50s or something. But here I was in my 30s, and I started to experience my body breaking down. You guys shared the story of Ken when you had a really difficult situation.
Yes.
I want you to kind of help us relive that moment, why it changed your mind. And then Mary, I want to know how you felt watching your partner go through this challenging experience.
You know what? I think we were really, really cool. I just thought it would be amazing. I don't know if you've done this on your podcast or channel before, to just read a segment from the book about that. Because I just think, I just think it will really speak to people. So let me try and read it. Okay, so I remember it like yesterday. I woke up confused, looked around and wondered where I was and why I was sitting on the floor in my pants. Everything seemed blurry, and I couldn't remember how I got there. 3 hours before, at 12:31 a.m., I'd arrived home from work after a grueling 15-hour shift, trying to meet my deadlines as a CFO at an investment business. The lonely 2-hour journey from London back to Kent had taken a further toll on me, and I had to walk home from the station in the bitter cold through dimly lit streets with only foxes for company. I remember thinking, is this the life that I always dreamed of? After all those years of working my way up the career ladder, here I was. Not only had I not spent time with my beautiful wife and children that evening, but I hadn't seen them properly for days. And although I didn't know it then, things were about to get worse. I got home and crashed out next to Mary. 3 hours later, I got up to use the bathroom, and as I would learn later, I immediately collapsed and hit my head on the bathroom sink. The loud bang awakened Mary, who desperately helped me regain consciousness. Another 3 hours later, the ambulance showed up, and while I sat at A&E waiting for a brain scan, I asked myself, why am I here? If you pay close attention to your life, you'll notice that it gives you signals about what's most important. The problem is, most of us either don't pay attention or we don't look out for the signals. Instead, we are all quietly working ourselves into the ground. That night, and the many hours in A&E would become a point of no return event. Like many others I'd experienced before, I took my phone out of my pocket and recorded a video speaking to the camera to remind myself of how I felt at that moment. I promised myself that I would never be here again and started reassessing my priorities immediately.
Yeah, that's just like bringing it all back. And it was honestly like one of the scariest experiences, because it was just like this loud thud that I heard and you were just so confused and disorientated. And I was trying to reassure you because I could see the panic like in your eyes. And I was literally freaking out, guys, but I was trying to be so calm because you were asking, babe, am I okay? Am I okay? And I was trying to wipe his head. There was like blood on the back of his head. There was blood on his chin as well, where he'd knocked it on like furniture in a bathroom. And I didn't want him to see it because I didn't want him to panic more. I just remember thinking, like you said in the book, it really was a point of no return, because we knew it was a crazy busy week and we hadn't got enough sleep. You're waking up early, going to bed late at night. And I knew it was, I didn't know for certain, but I gathered it was the lifestyle related cause of this, of you fainting. Yeah, I just remember thinking, like, babe, this isn't like the life that we spoke about when we said that we wanted to be intentional and design a life that we were happy with.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. Wow. Yeah, we've definitely had moments like that that just make you question why you're even here. And I actually have a theory about this and the limits on language that we have in the US, because we describe those moments as rock bottom. And everybody has an image in their head about what rock bottom is. It's not even having a home to fall in, right? It's like, I have nothing. And that's really not what it, that's not how we should be thinking about it. We should be thinking about it as those moments where you're so tuned out from what your body is trying to tell you. That you miss the message, because that connection between your mind and your body is one of the most important connections that you can have. That's what keeps you aligned.
Yeah.
So I want to take you to another moment where it was leaving it all behind, which is the moment you quit your job, Kim. Yes. You know, you used to be a CFO, a chief financial officer, and you turned into a content creator.
Yes.
And I think here in the US, there's like a growing appreciation for the lifestyle and the career of a creator. Sure. But there's still a lot of fear, like a lot of fear. And people don't see it as this viable way to make a living, especially if they have had a great amount of career success in something else. They kind of see that as a sunk cost. If they had made it to be a CFO or an attorney or a doctor, the idea of giving it all up to be a content creator is very scary.
Yes.
You somehow figured out how to get over that fear. What do you think people are misunderstanding about the creator economy, or what special sauce did you have? what can you give other people that want to get over the fear?
Okay, so let me give you some context. So I used to work as a chief financial officer for a venture capital business. So we used to raise tens or hundreds of millions of pounds, and we'd invest it in the creative industries in the UK. So into creative companies, maybe £5 million each time into companies. And then we'd look to exit those companies maybe in 5 to 7 years. That was the principal business model of what we did. And my job was as a chief financial officer, helping to essentially help that business exist and run properly and not run out of money, and help with all the fundraising and all those things. Very, very stressful job, very well paid. Like, in fact, I remember very clearly, as part of, there's a thing called a carried interest, which is a pool of money you have a potential for if all the investments go very well and all those things. And my pool, I've never really talked about this, but I can tell you, my pool worked out to be something in the region of £3 to £4 million if everything worked out. And, you know, so I, the reason I give that context is that number was like a carrot that was being dangled in front of me that made the possibility of quitting even harder.
Yes.
Because you're like, what if that actually happened? You know, I'm leaving behind this potential, you know, that could become something, but also could become nothing, right? Because it's venture capital. Things could go completely the other way, you know. But COVID was a big decider. So the pandemic, I left in April 2020, and it was one of the hardest moments of my life, because not only did I have a very demanding job, which I now needed to do from home, and it was a board level role, so lots of responsibility, but I also had, you know, my marriage. I also have children who we now needed to start to homeschool from home.
We had the Humble Penny. Financial Joy Academy.
Exactly.
Well.
And all these things were taking off on our YouTube channel. Yeah. The side hustle was doing well. My mental health was not in a great place at all. It felt like a collision of different forces. And Mary and I kind of looked at each other and said, look, we've been working on building off, you know, our fire pot and trying to really prepare. We're in a good place financially. Why isn't this the time? But it took something for me to either take the jump or be pushed. And it took a big global event for me to say, actually, this is a time to actually have a go at trying to do this thing. But it was harder than that, because as you say, I'd built my career for 14 years. I've been working since 2006, you know, so, and I trained, I'd done my MBA, I'd done all these things, but I needed to embrace a new mindset, which is that I'm not defined by just this one possible career path.
Yeah.
I needed to understand that I am I have many other possibilities, many other creative abilities, and I needed to find a way of tapping into them. And beginning a small side hustle was the way. The Humble Penny was like the beginning of that. I was teaching myself that I wasn't just limited to understanding numbers as an accountant and understanding spreadsheets. I could explore my inbuilt creativity in a very different way. And I also really embraced the idea of portfolio work, because we were starting to notice a trend, which is that in the city of London, for example, in the financial services industry, you don't see people beyond the age of 50, really. A lot of the employers find a way of exiting people who are older somehow through, you know, ageism. There's a process where they just don't hire people who are older and much more experienced because they're much more expensive. They hire much younger, more affordable people. So I knew, particularly as a black man, that my days were numbered in the corporate world. You know, that eventually I would either need to jump or get pushed at some stage. And I might have other challenges like health issues or just other things that might mean that if I don't create another alternative pathway, then I might find myself pigeonholed, you know. So weighing all those things up, as well as agreeing with Mary, we said, you know what? Yeah, this is it. This is the worst possible time to take a leap during the pandemic. But we're like, this is a leap of faith, man. Let's go for it. Let's literally throw everything into this thing happening and see what happens. Now, I do have to say it helped that we were looking after our personal finances, because that created a foundation, because then it's a bit like a runway for a company. You're like, oh, actually, a business has, I don't know, 2-year runway, or, you know, a period of time over which they could, their balance sheet could sustain them. In the same way, we had to look at our personal balance sheet, our net worth, and say, well, actually, how much longer could we, you know, operate without any issues? And that was good for us. And so the remainder was a mental leap, you know, which is, are you okay with not worrying about what other people think? Because a lot of this is my ex-colleagues. What's my ex-boss going to say? What's my ex-colleague going to say? What's my, you know, people I went to university going to say? What's, a lot of it is, what are other people going to say? A lot of the worry is how we feel about other people. And so provided Mary and I were like, we're okay with what we're doing,
yeah,
that was the leap. But you have, I'm sure you have something to add to that.
Yeah, I guess I could see how weighed down you were mentally, how much your job really stressed you out.
Yes.
And so, yeah, I think for me, it was a no-brainer. Like, the Humble Penny was doing really well. Financial Joy Academy had just started. It was a baby. But it just felt right. It just felt right. We'd become mortgage free. So that was, we didn't have that worry of that big, like, monthly payments. Yeah. And we were quite, you know, we were living well. Within our means. We're doing well. We weren't living flashy. So I wasn't actually worried for a moment. It was literally a no-brainer. I had done it the year before.
2019.
In 2019.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was just a great job. It was a great
decision. Do you know one thing I want to say? Because I like to keep it real with you guys. For me, it was the thing about losing the six-figure salary.
Yeah.
Right? Because I'd become so accustomed to getting it. And also your identity's tied to your LinkedIn title and your salary. So I'd become so caught up in the identity I had by calling myself a CFO, as well as the paycheck, the perks, the, you know, the insurance, the, you know, the fruits in the office, all the freebies, you know, all this stuff. Yeah. You
know, I don't have to pay for apples.
Yeah. What do you mean we got to buy apples? Yeah.
Anyway, I haven't bought an apple in years.
Yeah. No, I think that's funny because people are so attached to the LinkedIn title, but not the description. When you go down to the about and they say, I'm a leader who gets all of these results, it's like, well, what happened to that person?
Yeah.
Like, be attached to that person so that you can pursue other things that aren't attached to this title. Like, I wish more people had the courage to ask themselves those questions, which I think are so brilliant. Why isn't this the right time? And why do we care so much about what other people think? Because I think if you can get clarity on those two areas, you can at least start to uncover what you're actually afraid of, whether it's running out of money or not having the relationship with people that you thought you might, or whatever it is. And a lot of those business problems are actually solvable. The mental work you got to do on your own, but process pieces of just finding clientele and increasing your close rate and learning how to do marketing, all of that stuff is learnable. So I wish more people were willing to confront what they're actually afraid of, you like you guys were.
I want to just chip into that. Like, I've become infinitely more talented since I left that corporate job.
Yeah, same.
Like, the level of skill set, the level of, like, variety, like, I cannot tell you how, like, the rate at which we're moving, the rate at which we're able to make decisions quickly, the rate at which we're able to, you know, say no to this and yes to this and create this type of stuff and, you know, just operate with a certain level of intention and fearlessness, you know, has come from taking the leap, you know, and trying to build our own table, which is so important because then you're able to wake up with a lot more, I just feel a lot more purposeful. You know, I wake up and I'm like, wow, like, we're actually doing our own stuff. We took, we are being brave with this stuff. We're actually doing it. We're not just saying it. We're not just listening to other people. We're trying. It doesn't always work out perfectly. The times when it doesn't go as well, it's up and down in seasons, but at the core of it, we're actually doing it and we're changing the world in our own way. And that for me is just like, wow, you know. You know, in fact, getting, you know, getting to a point where we've written a book, things like that just makes me think, wow, imagine, had we not began this journey, we would never be authors, we'd never have our own business, we'd never have our own, you know, the level of freedom we have. Like, we can wake up and just go, I'm taking a day off today.
Yes.
I don't need to tell anyone. I'm literally just signing out.
Yeah.
And that's so important, that freedom. Like, we take, like, I never had that freedom. Like, for example, we plan every year now, we take August, the month of August, off. We switch off and we go traveling. I could never dream of doing that, no matter how much I was paid. In fact, the higher I rose in my corporate job, the less time I had.
Yes.
Because I had more responsibility, I paid more taxes. There were so many things that just made me think, well, actually, is this really the right path for me?
Yeah.
Or am I just wedded to the idea of looking good to other people rather than really being brave and pursuing what I felt like I really wanted to do in my life?
Yeah, this is what I wanted to uncover a few years ago when we had originally planned to shoot Money on the Table season 2.
I remember that, yes.
Yeah.
And I was so excited about doing that. And we weren't able to do that. But for any of our listeners out there, these guys were slated to be in that original season. I remember when we came across the idea and I immediately started doing research on neighborhoods in London and restaurants and all of that stuff.
I want to
stay on one of the points that you made as you were answering the last question. You were talking a little bit about your ethnicity and the experiences being Black in the UK. Obviously, that's a component of our message as well. The two go hand in hand. We don't shy away from those conversations. Now, our listeners are far more familiar with what those challenges look like here in the US. They're likely less familiar with what it looks like in the UK. But I want to drill a little bit deeper there because I'll share with you one of my theories, and I can't recall if I've shared this with you or not. And I will also add a little disclaimer because I got my hand slapped online. Someone basically called me elitist for making this observation, but that was not my intention. It was really just me not being able to ignore the fact that I felt and what I saw based on my assessment of the personal finance and media space, that there was a disproportionate percentage of Black people who were African and or Caribbean, right? So if only, you know, let's say 20% of the population here in the US were African or Caribbean, it felt as if around 40 or 50% of them who were very much drawn to financial independence and personal finance seemed to be of those two subgroups. I'm curious if you see similar dynamics or proportion differences in the UK.
Yes.
If not, that's fine. But what do you see and what are the challenges that might be unique to Black people that are at work in the UK that maybe our listeners and viewers in the US might be able to identify with.
Yeah, we can share different various perspectives on that. So to that point you made about, let's talk about the personal finance space, for example. So in the UK, I'd say the top voice, the top black voices in the space are overwhelmingly African. Over, like, how many percent would you say?
Oh, probably 70
more than 80.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like 9 out of 10 of them, maximum. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Overwhelmingly. Mm-hmm. Now, if you ask me why, I'd just say we are very, first of all, we, a lot of us are, first of all, immigrants to the country. Mm-hmm. So, and we're later immigrants, right? So mm-hmm. Africans came in a bit later compared to other ethnicities in the UK, like the Indians and, you know, other
Caribbeans.
The Caribbeans came a bit earlier as well. Yeah. Now, and also there's a culture of being, I'd say our ethnicity, our culture of being Nigerian, we come from a culture of being enterprising. Mm-hmm. So for example, like our last name, Okoro Afo, it's like two words brought together. Okoro means a young man, and Afo is a market day. So back in the day, there used to be about 4 market days. And so Okoro Afo is like a young man who trades on the 3rd market day. So our heritage has come from buying and selling and dealing with money and trying to make it and figure out a way to exist and become successful and all those things. So I bring that up to say that the people who are in this space are always trying to evolve and, you know, interrogate the space and look further beyond the UK, look at the US, look at other spaces and go like, these guys are smashing it. They're doing this. They're doing this. Why are we not doing it over here? They're trying to do similar things, right? So that's the first observation, which is, interestingly, as you say, they're mostly of African heritage, mostly. Some are Caribbean, Afro-Caribbean, but those are overwhelmingly the main two groups.
Yeah.
Now, as to observations from a black perspective in the UK, I'd say that our observations are that black Americans, kind of looking at you guys from the UK, a lot of you guys are, the impression we get is that economically, a lot of black people in America, or maybe in certain parts of America, maybe Atlanta and places like that, are a lot more ahead in terms of they've just, I don't know, they own stuff, like they own buildings, they own like, I don't know, man, like they just own stuff, you know, they're like, they just own stuff. Whereas in the UK, ownership is, I'll give an example, the research shows a black African has 10% net worth of a white British person in the UK. 10%.
Yeah.
That's actually quite a shocking statistic. And around 20% of black Africans, 40% of Caribbeans own a home in the UK, own their own home. Whereas around 74% of Indians own their own home in the UK. Yeah. So ownership is something we would like to see more of. Like, you know, it's not natural for us to own stuff, for us to say, oh, we own that building, we own that shopping mall, we own that, you know, it's very rare. Whereas in America, I might be generalizing, but in certain parts of America, our observation is that it's much more likely to see stuff like that, to see people who run banks and it's owned by a black person, see a person who runs, you know, whereas in the UK, I don't know a single bank that's owned by any black person anything like that. You know, there's still a lot of, I feel like we have some way to go.
Yeah, it's like we're actually playing catch up. Like you said, the Africans migrated over to the UK much later than other ethnicities. So there is this gap, like when you mentioned the percentages in the terms of the amount of assets that we have.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's a thing where baby boomers are going, there's going to be a big transfer of wealth from the baby boomers to the millennials. But, you know, that might not be the case so much for the Africans.
Correct.
In the UK, because our parents and their parents, well, their parents weren't even in the UK. So it's our parents that were still building up their assets. Mm-hmm. So there isn't really much of a generational wealth that we can transfer. See tangibly within the African community, somewhat more so with the Caribbean community. But there's definitely a lot of catch up that we're doing. So mm-hmm. I guess in a sense, it's made us more enterprising and made us more, what's the word? We really want to improve our finances so that we can do better for our children.
Yeah. And in the workplace, although Black people in the UK, African, Caribbean, or generally, are actually pretty educated relative to other ethnicities, mm-hmm. they earn significantly less. Significantly less. You know, so there are massive wealth gaps that exist, you know, between what a white British person might earn of the same qualification mm-hmm. compared to a Black Caribbean or Black African person of the same qualification. And these are all like based on data. You can go and look it up at the Office for National Statistics in the UK, the official body that produces all the stats. It's all in black and white, you know. So there are massive wealth gaps, and these are all connected to many challenges, lots of systemic racism mm-hmm. that still exists today that we are navigating in different ways. You see that, you see it in the media every day. You see it in, you know, we had a recent one with a politician. You know, there's so many things that happen, you know, and it gets even worse if you are a Black woman, in the UK. It's even more of a problem, you know. Yeah. And then there are challenges around raising Black boys in the UK. We've got two Black boys, so raising them in the UK is a challenge because they're much more likely to be targeted by the system, by the police, by, you know, just how things work over here. And, you know, raising them, we have to be very careful in making sure that their environment, they grow up in, they are put in the right spaces to be around the right sort of people, you know, just so that they're not in the wrong place at the wrong time, because there are things that can happen. So there are all these things. And then you've got the workplace sort of challenges of trying to break that glass ceiling, you know, trying to get into that sea level, and then trying to fight for your income. And then, you know, there's just so many of those things where there aren't really, you know, pre that period, you know, there was a lot of there's a lot of massive challenges. And even at that period, there's a lot of lip service that kind of kicked in, all these funds on, you know, this black fund, that black fund,
yeah.
and all these organizations who made all these like promises, mm-hmm. but they've all quietly, you know, disappeared. They've just like quietly, you know, like disbanded all these like schemes, you know, and they were all for a season only. And then we're back to the same place again, where although we feel we've progressed somewhat, actually, if you look at it in black and white, we actually haven't progressed as much as we would like. No. But the you know, the struggles remain, you know, which is why we're so empowered with what we're doing with this journey of, you know, teaching people how to become, you know, financially savvy, financially literate, working on their money behaviors and relationships is so key, because then if we're able to start to look after the money that's coming into our households, mm-hmm. then we can start to better deploy capital. We can learn how to create investments. We can learn how to look for the ROI for our investments. We can learn how to start enterprises, acquire assets, and so on. We did a book signing, 2 days ago, mm-hmm. and the book signing was at an event. The building was bought by this guy who's a young Nigerian guy in his late 30s or early 40s. Massive building.
Yeah.
He is one of only maximum a handful of people who has been able to make that sort of move in the UK where they can say, I own a shopping mall, or I own, you know, what we want to see is for that to become normalized, you know, for that to become a reality, not just like an exception. But for us to see, well, actually, in our lifetime, not even in our children's lifetime, in our lifetime, we're able to see people take up positions of power in government, in politics, in our communities. They're able to provide services, they're able to own assets, they're able to feel, you know, a lot more financially secure. You know, all those things are still, I guess, building its way up.
But I'm hopeful because I feel like our generation are better at sharing knowledge and information, whereas the generation before us, they didn't really talk about money, whereas the Asians, the Sikhs, they would help each other out. They'll bring each other. They're buying up properties, they're coming together, doing joint ventures.
Yes.
And we've not been able to do that.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's because of like, you know, this tribe or that tribe or beef, just unnecessary like bickering. I don't know. And us not being able to work together, it's actually held us back.
Scarcity mindset.
Exactly. Yeah. But I feel like we're a bit different now and we're definitely sharing the knowledge. So hopefully we'll see, you know, more people, more Black Africans, more Black Caribbeans doing joint things together and buying property because they're more informed than their parents were ever informed.
Yeah, I was just going to add that. And seeing us and the unity of us does something incredible for the Black kids in the UK.
Yeah.
Like people come to us and like, wow, I just love you guys. Just seeing you guys leveling up and really, you know, operating from a beautiful place with court, you know, really beautiful intentions, putting out excellent work and really being consistent with what you're doing is really like helping to elevate so many people. That's why it's another, you know, to Julian's point about like some of our intentions and motivations for what we're doing today. For me, it's about that, you know, it's about like, wow, we actually have the opportunity to change the financial destiny of millions of people.
Yeah.
We actually know we have that potential. So it's like, and we're doing it with very limited resources, you know, our YouTube channel, our blog, and like just showing up consistently and like literally having the conversations people want to have about issues that are bothering them and like, you know, writing a book and putting it out there. So this is what gives us that purpose today. It's like
our calling that we do feel like it is our purpose and our calling. And so it's a passion project for us. So even though we do have the flexibility, the freedom to do what we want, like we enjoy doing what we do.
Just
getting the feedback from people, just having the testimonials, the amount of DMs we get, like, guys, we paid off our mortgage, thanks to you.
Yeah.
So many. Like, we paid it off in 10 years.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
That's incredible.
So, it's incredible.
I want to ask a follow-up question, and I wasn't, I think I had it in my notes, but I think I was going to ask it later on. Is there something that you think we take for granted here in the U.S.?
I'd probably say, I think, firstly, the fact that there are as many Black people in America as they are relative to, say, the UK, for example. Like the Black population in the UK, I think we make up, I don't know, maybe 3%, something like, I don't know what the population, you know, in America, I don't know what the Black population is.
It depends on a number of factors, but last count, it was 12 or 13%.
Yeah. So I feel like, you know, I don't know if you guys take it for granted, but I think it's maybe something that's maybe overlooked as to the presence you have. The fact that, you know, like, Atlanta, right? I look at places like that. I'm like what? Like a place like that? Yes. You know, it's like this place, Atlanta, there's like Black wealthy people.
Yeah,
and I'm like,
exactly.
That's just like ridiculous. That's just like amazing. Yeah. Like, wow, that exists.
Yeah.
Incredible. Right.
Yeah.
So we don't have that. Like, we don't have that, you know, here. It's like, wow, like you guys have this place where, you know, it's normal for Black people to be very successful, whether it's in business and politics and whatever. So we would love to see more of that kind of stuff. And it's also, you know, over here, there's all this like, and Hasha put this, political correctness. That's it. Like, you know, like there's all this like, I kind of feel like Americans are more, they just call a spade a spade.
You know where you stand.
That's kind of like how I feel looking from the outside. I feel like Americans can just say like,
you talk about freedom of speech,
like Black stuff, Black issues, Black. Whereas here, because we're still quite a small minority group, it's just harder to talk about certain things, you know, and have certain experiences without it creating certain problems, you know, and that sort of thing. Oh, and the other thing worth mentioning is you guys talk about money much more openly.
Yes.
Whereas in the UK, it's much more of a taboo subject.
Yeah.
Big taboo subject.
Big.
Woof. People don't want to talk about it.
Yeah.
They don't want to talk about how much they make. Mm-hmm. They don't want to talk about anything. It's just harder.
It's very hush-hush.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a big one, actually.
Yeah, culture.
Culture.
Money and culture, yeah. Yeah.
That's so interesting because I read an article a couple of years ago that called Americans the most passively indoctrinated people on earth because we know very little about our own history, but we certainly don't know the histories of other places. Mm. And when it comes to calling ourselves the land of the free, we actually have learned to enjoy far less freedoms than people who live in other places. So to your point, things like ownership, things like freedom to say what you want, a lot of people don't actually take advantage of those freedoms because of fear of the consequences of doing so. So it's interesting to hear your perspective. And even when we were writing our book, we were thinking about that paradox of like being land of the free, but so many people afraid to touch freedom.
Yeah.
And when we talked about culture and how that impacts it, the place that we kept landing on was religion. And we went back and forth about whether to incorporate religion and the role that it plays in how free you feel, how much you're willing to say, and even how it impacts your money was something that we went back and forth on. And I thought you guys took a really impressive approach to incorporating religion because you added it to one of the core principles of financial joy. Yes. You say that faith is a currency in your finances. And I just, I love that because I've heard you say it over and over again. I've heard you say that, you know, we've made progress in some places, but not others, or we're just not there yet. But Mary will chime in and say, but I'm hopeful because now we're talking about it. And there are these tools and technology that's there to kind of close that gap a little bit.
Yeah.
And so I want you to talk about what it means and how it relates to money and honestly, how that's kept you optimistic or at least hopeful that there are so many areas that we're not making progress in or progress is coming slower than we would like it to, but you're still in there trying. Can you talk a little bit about faith and the role that it plays in your money?
Yeah, so we always talk about taking faith walks. And I guess it's because we are people of faith and we believe in committing all our plans to God, but then also being faithful to carry out, you know, if we have an idea or a plan, we commit to God in prayers, right? And then we take the next step of faith, which is to start the thing, do the thing. Because a lot of people, if they are people of faith, can just be stuck in the prayer mode, but they're not taking action, right? So we believe the importance of faith and action working together. And also we feel that we are just stewards of money.
Yeah.
And because of that, we're very intentional with what we do with our money. We don't use it to spend it. We don't spend it recklessly. We're not wasteful. Mm. And we like to invest it wisely and get a good return on our investment. And we speak about, you know, the parables of
email. Yeah. So it's interesting this point actually, because we wanted to write the book in a way that was open to people who have no faiths at all.
Yeah.
Such that even the people who are people of faith can feel like we were still being authentic in the way we wrote the book. And we were, you know, I kept telling our editor, I don't want to write a lukewarm book. I don't want anyone to pick the book up and go, like, these guys have not really shown who they are in the book. So we wanted to really, but also we didn't want it to be off-putting. We wanted it to be relatable and to create curiosity for the reader and make them wonder, okay, I wonder if this is something I might want to, you know, consider for my life.
Mm.
But I think, I guess, this all goes back to our childhood and growing up. So we grew up in the church, Mary and I, and, you know, just that journey has informed so much of our lives. Like, for example, a lot of my life has really worked out with, I always look at it as, I always felt like I've been guided by an invisible hand. Mm. And there are many things that work out, and I'm like, there's no way this would have worked out. Like, there's just no way, right? And I know it's not just like me operating under my own strength. I know there's just another guiding power that's leading and operating on the journey. Now, my bit is for me to have the humility to recognize that, and have the faith to and to be guided by it. So a lot of our journey and a lot of my personal struggle has always been just recognizing that I'm here as a manager of resources. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm here to look after many things,
yeah.
from talents to bank accounts to investments to the many things. And having the humility to recognize that my role really is to say, hey, here's $100, go over here, or here's £500, go over here. I'm really directing resources to go places. Now, but without the arrogance of, hey, you know, I created all this stuff and, you know, this is like my, you know, having that humility has taught me that, you know, I almost look at wealth as a flow. It's mm-hmm. a flow through our lives. And provided we operate with this sense of intention and recognizing that we are stewards of resources, mm-hmm. the flow will always be abundant. It will always flow towards us. And it's a question of where do we want the flow to go? As careful managers of the flow, we're able to say, okay, go over here and go over here and go to that project and go to that area. So as Mary talks about, the faith walk is really bringing together the practical and the spiritual together, mm-hmm. and making sure that they can coexist, because a lot of our money walk is just physical. We're like, oh yeah, I can see £100 or $100. That's all I've got. When in actual fact, is a money is actually a spiritual thing. Money is actually like a currency. It's like energy mm-hmm. that flows, and the energy with which you manage money is the energy with which the person who receives it will receive it. You know, so you can pass on that energy to other people. You can bless money as you give that money, and that money can become more abundant in other people's lives. Mm-hmm. So it's, for us, writing the book, how do we wanted to find a way of the language to describe this such that people felt like they understood it somehow, or they could embrace it somewhat. And that's where we came up with the idea of it being faith being a currency in our finances. And I just felt like a good way to kind of describe it so that people understood the flow of it and the connection to faith as well.
That's what I love about writing. that is what I love about writing, because if you can give somebody the language, the metaphor, the example, the connection, you can unlock something in their lives. And that's what books do. That's why it's so powerful to write one and to have somebody read it, because when somebody reads a book, they're ready to change their lives.
Yeah.
And when they come across something like that to take away the power that money had over them, that was leading them to make these, you know, decisions that weren't ideal. I won't call them bad decisions, but non-ideal decisions. To read that faith is the currency in your finances as a means to keep going, to keep trying, to try something different, to let go of certain things.
Yes.
I just, it's great. Like, I don't have to keep, I don't have to keep fangirling. Yeah. It's amazing.
Can I just tell you something? And I kind of like, something different about that. It was interesting, that point, because that page in the book was a big arm wrestle with our editors, because my personality, right, is like, I like to fight for what I believe in, right?
Yeah, I'm happy.
And there was this almost move to not include that mm-hmm. piece in the book, or include that idea and that concept. But Mary and I were like, no, like, this is such a big part of who we are. How can you like try to like remove this? This is our book.
Yeah.
Like, we're going to strip out this part of your life. And like, you know, we don't want people to know about this area. We're just going to like, just talk about investing and that's it. We're like, no. I don't think you understand. This is our book, you know, and we want to understand that this is a big part of how we look at life, you know. So it took quite a few arm wrestles. I think that page is probably the most arm wrestled page in the book. You know, that page. Yeah. You know, trying to get to a point where we were like, okay, everyone's happy with the language. Everyone's happy with what we think it's saying.
Yeah. But to be fair, right, you see, when we finished the book, it was 120,000 words. So we went way over. It was only supposed to write 60,000.
Yeah.
It's still quite thick. When people pick up the book, they say, wow, it's quite a chunky book. I'm like, they had no idea. It would have been double the size.
Yeah.
So it was a challenge to try and reduce the word count.
Yeah.
I've come to realize that the best books are those that went through some type of struggle, right? Mm-hmm. Because we have very similar, you know, obviously I'm biased, but we had very similar struggles with several parts of our book. Yeah. And I think what it does is it leads you to believing in what you wrote that much more, yeah, right? You defended it. Yeah. It also presents a very real bridge between you and the reader that you have in mind. You understand who they are. You understand what their challenges are. And there's a reason why you use the words that you decided to use. And so I applaud you guys for being willing to fight that fight, because I know as first time authors, especially if you're just happy to be there, there's the tendency to
say yes to everything.
To yield to people who have the best intentions, but may not necessarily understand you, your story, your message, or
your reader,
your audience.
Right. Yeah.
I have one more question for you guys, and I know we're a little over. And you guys are 4 hours ahead, so I appreciate your patience with us. In the book, you guys also created some personas. You have 13 personas that you identified. We will not go through all of them, but the one that I believe, if I had to pick, best describes a significant portion of our audience is who you would call the dreamers.
Yes.
And you define them as being highly ambitious, driven by big dreams and aspirations.
Yes.
What message do you think dreamers need to get out of the book?
Wow.
I love
so interesting, actually. I love the question. So interesting. The people who read this book, we call the dream makers. Mm-hmm. All right. So it's actually interesting you asking us that question and pick that particular persona in the book. I think one thing I've learned as someone who had to figure out what we believed we were dreaming about and then try to figure out how do we achieve that dream, one thing for sure that helped us on the journey is very clearly that helped us a lot was having what we called our 10-year plan. Mm-hmm. I mentioned that because a lot of people dream about stuff, but don't have a mechanism for how to day by day convert the dream into a reality. There isn't a mechanism. So in the book, we teach a framework in the book, the POST framework, POST. And that framework is effectively a tool set to help people take an idea and put it into everyday language and action steps. I'll just kind of walk through what that looks like. So the P in POST stands for purpose. So what we want the dreamer to do is to cast their vision and ask themselves, like, what's the purpose for what I'm trying to do, or who I'm trying to become, or where I'm trying to go? What is the purpose to it? What's the why? Why does any of it matter at all? Like, what does that actually look like for me? And that's very important, because if you don't write that down, if you don't discuss that, if you've got a partner, discuss it with them and almost paint a picture for your why, it's like building a house without a foundation at all. It's actually completely pointless trying to achieve any goals. The why is a beautiful frame for the day when things get tough. And there'll be many tough days as a dreamer, many tough days. But having that why means that when things get tough, you can kind of remind yourself or remind each other, hey, here's the purpose for why we're doing what we're doing. So the P is for purpose. Now the O stands for objectives, which is the goal. Like, okay, you've cast the vision, you set that picture for what you want to try and do, but what does it look like in numbers? So a lot of people say things like, I want to become financially free, or I want to like have no money worries. Like, what does that actually mean? Like, what does it mean for you? Forget like what it means for the person on Instagram or anyone on wherever. What does it mean for you specifically, right? So the dreamer needs to take that picture they're painting in purpose and put it into very tangible numbers. For example, I want to have an investment portfolio of, I don't know, making it up, $700,000. And I also want to have two or three rental properties paying me $5,000 a month by the year 2030, right? Very clear, very tangible, and it's connected to the why that you set out initially, right? So very clear what we're aiming for. And that's a picture. Now, the reason that picture is important is when your friend comes to you and says, hey, I've come across this idea and this opportunity, you can then ask yourself, does that idea align with the goal that I'm trying to achieve and the purpose for which this goal is attached? If it doesn't align, you can very politely say, no, thank you, and focus on what you're trying to do. Now, the dreamer then is to think, well, actually, outside of the objective, what's my strategy, which is the S in post. And the strategy we describe in the book as two things. It's who and how. Because a lot of time, people fix a lot on the how, which is, how am I going to do stuff? What's going to be my approach? Will it be stock market investing? Will I be going to entrepreneurship? Will I do this? Will I do that? Will I focus on my career? But they overlook the who. The who is, who could help you get there a lot quicker? Like, who's in your network? Like, who could I join a mastermind with these guys and connect with, you know, Julian and Kirsten and like connect with them? Could they get me there quicker? Could I? And that who is so critical, because then you're almost introducing an accelerator to your dream, right? That's where the who comes in. And then the final piece is the T, which is the tactics, which is, what are then the small steps I would take every day? So when I wake up daily, like, what do I need to do today? What do I need to do this week to get me closer to executing that strategy to achieve my objective, to then achieve my purpose? So for the dreamer, although they are enthusiastic, they want to make things happen, they want to build their own table, having that framework helps. But also, one thing I'd add is relationship capital. Mm-hmm. A lot of people overlook the importance of, like, quality relationships. I'll give you an example. This today, we were on ITV. I mentioned to you ITV, the show ITV This Morning. That only happened because when we got invited, Mary and I built relationships in the green room. And from the green room, I said, hey, said to the producer, hey, I don't want to give you my business card. I want your number on my phone. She put her number on the phone so I could WhatsApp her, right? And from that, we could go back to her and go, hey, we pitched her an idea. She's like, yeah. We built a rapport, built a relationship. And from there, we got invited back on. So for the dreamer needs to know how to not only seize the moment. When they're in a space, they need to know how to look around and seize the moment. But out of that moment, think of reciprocity to build that relationship capital, which then helps to enable that tool set I talked about, the purpose, the objective, the strategy, the tactic, and so on.
Yeah, he said it perfectly. all I will add to is the relationship capital. It's so important that if you're a couple, to bring your couple in, actually, you know, dream together is so key, because the way we are now, I know that was accelerated because we dreamt together when we were on the beach in Pongwe, where there was no stress, no
Zanzibar
specifically, but we dreamt together, and that helped to accelerate our goals and our dreams. So yeah, if you're a couple, it's so important to have common goals, have your own goals, but definitely have common goals that you're working towards, and bring your partner in on your goals so that they can help you to fulfill that dream that you have and make it a reality.
Oh, and if I just chip one final bit really quick, is the dreamer can easily burn out. Very easily burn out.
Yes.
So one big tip that we're starting to really implement in our lives on the back of this book is the importance of putting joy at the center of your finances every week. So the dreamer should find one thing, literally one thing per week, that brings joy to their lives. It could be going to the movies, going out for a meal,
going for a walk.
You need to find that one thing that you block into your calendar as a dreamer that's parallel to doing all those things you need to do, all the activities. You have this one thing you're looking forward to that will help to give you that balance and really protect your well-being effectively. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Beautiful.
Guys, thank you. Thank you so much. I'm so happy for you and proud of you. I can't wait to meet you in person.
Right?
It's interesting that we've had so many exchanges,
but
we haven't actually connected in person. So I look forward to that day. And until then, thank you guys so much.
If people want to purchase Financial Joy or just keep up with your journey, where should they find you?
Yes. So if you want to purchase this book, head over to Amazon. Amazon's a good place. Barnes & Noble, Waterstones, W.H. Smith's. It's available in physical copy. So it's a 10-week plan to help you banish debt, grow your money, and unlock financial freedom. So it's very practical inside, so you can do all your exercises in it. Mm-hmm. And it's for single people and couples. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can feel included on that journey. But you can also get the audio version. So we found people buying the audio version and the physical book. So they can listen on the go, but they can also get this version to do it for themselves. And we found couples getting a copy each. So, I write my piece in the books.
It's really practical.
She writes her bits in the book.
Spaces to write down your reflections and things.
I love it.
Yeah. And feel free to, find us at The Humble Penny on Instagram, YouTube, TikTok, LinkedIn. We're using LinkedIn now, by the way, which is just fantastic.
I was more impressed by the TikTok. I'm still trying to decide if we're joining or not.
We're still playing around with it. We're not quite there, but YouTube, Instagram, TikTok, LinkedIn, and our blog at thehumblepenny.com. Yeah,
so awesome.
It's just to connect with us.
Guys, we just want to thank you
for
your support. You guys have been amazing.
Phenomenal.
Just from, helping to write down a review. You've got a quote here. So you guys have been amazing and just great friends to have. To pick your brain. So thank you.
Yeah. And your generosity, it's really heartwarming to meet people like you. We've never met in person, like you said, but it's just beautiful to watch you guys. To watch your authenticity, to watch your intention, to watch your togetherness. Mm-hmm. Like, keep going, man. We're cheering you guys on from the UK. We shout you out everywhere we go. We're like, connect with these guys. So, man, just going to say we love you guys. We're literally proud of you. You inspire us in so many ways. So, keep pushing.
Thank you.
And we love you guys too.
Yes.
If you like videos like this and want to see more, make sure you click subscribe and turn on notifications.